content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. This week, I will read the final section of the short story, Zoe, by J.D. Salinger, the 11th of the 13 short stories J.D. Salinger published in the New Yorker magazine. If you missed any of the previous sections of the short story, they are available on the website ncreadingservice.org and the podcast section, New Yorker Magazine. And now a recap of the first four sections of the story. Franny comes home from college in a state of collapse. She is suffering spiritually, and it takes a great deal of talking on the part of her brother Zoe to straighten her out. She is 20, he is 25. There are several older brothers and another sister. The oldest child, Seymour, had committed suicide 7 years earlier. He had been a directive force in the family and was sorely missed. The next oldest boy, Buddy, who'd been very close to Seymour, now lived in a distant college town, teaching and writing. Mrs. Glass, their mother, simply wanted things to go smoothly. She wanted Franny to take some chicken broth and clear out of the living room so the painters could come in. Zoe's important conversation with Franny led to a clearing up of her thinking, especially on the religious level. She was reciting the Jesus prayer from the Way of a Pilgrim, but she didn't fully realize what she was doing. She was mean and uncharitable about everyone she knew at college. Zoe tried to explain true religious thinking to her, and when he finally succeeded, she was at peace. We left the story last time with Zoe entering Seymour, his brother who committed suicide 7 years ago, Seymour's bedroom. And now, part five of Zoe by J.D. Salinger. He gave the room itself scarcely a glance once he was inside it. Instead, he turned around and deliberately faced a sheet of what had once been snow-white beaver board that was nailed uncompromisingly to the back of the door. It was a mammoth specimen, very nearly as long and as wide as the door itself. One could have believed that its whiteness, smoothness, and expanse had at one time cried out rather plaintively for India ink and block lettering. Certainly not in vain, if so. Every inch of visible surface of the board had been decorated with four somewhat gorgeous-looking columns of quotations from a variety of the world's literatures. The lettering was minute, but jet-black and passionately legible, if just a trifle fancy in spots, and without blots or erasures. The workmanship was no less fastidious even at the bottom of the board, near the door sill, where the two penmen, each in his turn, had obviously lain on their stomachs. No attempt whatever had been made to assign quotations or authors to categories or groups of any kind. So that to read the quotations from top to bottom, column by column, was rather like walking through an emergency station set up in a flood area, where, for example, Pascal had been unribaldly bedded down with Emily Dickinson, and where, so to speak, Baudelaire's and Thomas à Kempis's toothbrushes were hanging side by side. Zoe, standing in just close enough, read the top entry in the left-hand column, and then went on reading downward. From his expression, or lack of it, he might have been killing time on a railway platform reading a billboard advertisement for Dr. Scholl's footpads. You have the right to work, but for the work's sake only. You have no right to the fruits of work. Desire for the fruits of work must never be your motive in working. Never give way to laziness either. Perform every action with your heart fixed on the Supreme Lord. Renounce attachment to the fruits. Be even-tempered, underlined by one of the calligraphers, in success and failure, for it is this evenness of temper which is meant by yoga. Work done with anxiety about results is far inferior to work done without such anxiety in the calm of self-surrender. Seek refuge in the knowledge of Brahman. They who work selfishly for results are miserable. Bhagavad Gita. It loved to happen, Marcus Aurelius. Oh, snail, climb Mount Fuji, but slowly, slowly, Issa. Concerning the gods, there are those who deny the very existence of the Godhead. Others say that it exists, but neither bestirs nor concerns itself, nor has forethought for anything. A third party attribute to its existence a forethought, but only for great and heavenly matters, not for anything that is on earth. A fourth party admit things on earth as well as in heaven, but only in general and not with respect to each individual. A fifth, of whom were Ulysses and Socrates, are those that cry, I move not without thy knowledge. Epictetus. The love interest and climax would come when a man and a lady, both strangers, got to talking together on the train going back east. Well, said Mrs. Crute, for it was she, what do you think of the canyon? Some cave, replied her escort. What a funny way to put it, replied Mrs. Crute. And now play me something. Ring Lardner, How to Write Short Stories. God instructs the heart, not by ideas, but by pains and contradictions. De Kassov. Papa, shrieked Kitty and shut his mouth with her hands. Well, I won't, he said. I'm very, very pleased. Oh, what a fool I am. He embraced Kitty, kissed her face, her hand, her face again, and made the sign of the cross over her. And there came over Levin a new feeling of love for this man, till then so little known to him, when he saw how slowly and tenderly Kitty kissed his muscular hand. Anna Karenina. Sir, we ought to teach the people that they are doing wrong in worshipping the images and pictures in the temple. Ramakrishna. That's the way with you Calcutta people. You want to teach and preach. You want to give millions when you are beggars yourselves. Do you think God does not know that he is being worshipped in the images and pictures? If a worshipper should make a mistake, do you not think God will know his intent? The Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Don't you want to join us? I was recently asked by an acquaintance when he ran across me alone after midnight in a coffee house that was already almost deserted. No, I don't, I said. Kafka. The happiness of being with people. Kafka. St. Francis de Sales prayer. Yes, Father, yes, and always yes. Zwigan called out to himself every day, Master. Then he answered himself, Yes, sir. And then he added, Become sober. And again he answered, Yes, sir. And after that he continued, Do not be deceived by others. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, he replied. Mu Mon Quan. The lettering on the beaver board, being as small as it was, this last entry appeared well in the upper fifth of its column, and Zoe could have gone on reading for another 5 minutes or so, staying in the same column without having to bend his knees. He didn't choose to. He turned around, not abruptly, and walked over and sat down at his brother Seymour's desk, pulling out the little straight chair as though it were something he did every day. He placed his cigar on the right-hand edge of the desk, burning end out, leaned forward on his elbows, and covered his face with his hands. Behind him, and at his left, two curtained windows, with their blinds half-drawn, faced into a court, an unpicturesque brick and concrete valley through which cleaning women and grocery boys passed grayly at all hours of the day. The room itself was what might be called the third master bedroom of the apartment, and was, by more or less traditional Manhattan apartment house standards, both unsunny and unlarge. The two eldest boys, Seymour and Buddy, had moved into it in 1929 at the respective ages of 12 and 10, and had vacated it when they were 23 and 21. Most of the furniture belonged to a Maplewood set, two day beds, a night table, two boyishly small knee-cramping desks, two chiffoniers, two semi-easy chairs. Three domestic oriental scatter rugs, extremely worn, were on the floor. The rest with very little exaggeration, was books. Meant to be picked up books. Permanently left behind books. Uncertain what to do with books. But books, books, books. Tall cases lined three walls of the room, filled to and beyond capacity. The overflow had been piled in stacks on the floor. There was little space left for walking and none whatever for pacing. A stranger with a flair for cocktail party descriptive prose might have commented that the room, at a quick glance, looked as if it had once been tenanted by two struggling 12-year-old lawyers or researchers. And, in fact, unless one chose to make a fairly thoughtful survey of the reading matter extant, there were few, if any, certain indications that the former occupants had been both reached voting age within the predominantly juvenile dimensions of the room. True, there was a phone, the controversial private phone, on Buddy's desk, and there were a number of cigarette burns on both desks. But other, more emphatic signs of adulthood, stud or cuff button boxes, wall pictures, the telling odds and ends that collect on chiffonier's tops and had been removed from the room in 1940 when the two men branched out and took an apartment of their own. With his face in his hand and his handkerchief headgear drooping low over his brow, Zoe sat at Seymour's old desk, inert but not asleep, for a good 20 minutes. Then, almost in one movement, he removed the support for his face, picked up his cigar, stowed it in his mouth, opened the left-hand bottom drawer of the desk, and took out, using both hands, a 7 or 8 inch thick stack of what appeared to be, and were, shirt cardboards. He placed the stack before him on the desk and began to turn the cards over, two or three at a time. His hand stayed only once, really, and then quite briefly. The cardboard that he stopped at had been written on in February 1938. The handwriting in blue lead pencil was his brother Seymour's. My 21st birthday. Presents, presents, presents. Zoe and the baby, as usual, shopped Lower Broadway. They gave me a fine supply of itching powder and a box of 3 stink bombs. I'm to drop the bombs in the elevator at Columbia or someplace very crowded, as soon as I get a good chance. Several acts of vaudeville tonight for my entertainment. Les and Bessie did a lovely soft shoe on sand swiped by Boo Boo from the urn in the lobby. When they were finished, Bee and Boo Boo did a pretty funny imitation of them, Les nearly in tears. The baby sang Abdul Abdulbul Amir. Z did the Will Mahoney exit. Les taught him and ran smack into the bookcase and was furious. The twins did Bees and my old Buck and Bubbles imitation. But to perfection. Marvelous. In the middle of it, the doorman called up on the house phone and asked if anybody was dancing up there. A Mr. Seligman on the 4th. There Zoe quit reading. He gave the stack of cardboards a solid-sounding double tap on the desk surface as one taps a deck of cards, and then dropped the stack back into the bottom drawer and closed the drawer. Once again, he leaned forward on his elbows and buried his face in his hands. This time, he sat motionless for almost a half hour. When he moved again, it was as though marionette strings had been attached to him and given an overzealous yank. He appeared to be given just enough time to pick up his cigar before another jerk of the invisible strings swung him over to the chair at the second desk in the room, Buddy's desk, where the phone was. In this new seating arrangement, the first thing he did was to pull his shirt ends out of his trousers. He unbuttoned the shirt completely, as if the journey of 3 steps had taken him into an oddly tropical zone. Next, he took his cigar out of his mouth, but transferred it to his left hand and kept it there. With his right hand, he took his handkerchief off his head and laid it beside the phone, in what was then very implicitly a ready position. He then picked up the phone without any perceptible hesitation and dialed a local number. A very local number, indeed. When he had finished dialing, he picked up his handkerchief from the desk and put it over the mouthpiece, quite loosely and mounted rather high. He took a deepish breath and waited. He might have lighted his cigar, which had gone out, but he didn't. About a minute and a half earlier, Franny, on a distinctly quavering note, had just declined her mother's fourth offer within 15 minutes to bring in a cup of nice hot chicken broth. Mrs. Glass had made this last offer on her feet, in fact halfway out of the living room in the direction of the kitchen, looking rather grim with optimism. But the reintroduced quaver in Franny's voice had sent her quickly back to her chair. Mrs. Glass's chair was, of course, on Franny's side of the living room, and most vigilantly so. Some 15 minutes earlier, when Franny had been rehabilitated enough to sit up and look around for her comb, Mrs. Glass had brought over the straight chair from the writing table and placed it squarely up against the coffee table. The sight was excellent for Franny observing, and also placed the observer within easy reach of an ashtray on the marble surface. Reseated, Mrs. Glass sighed, as she always sighed, in any situation, when cups of chicken broth were declined. But she had, so to speak, been cruising in a patrol boat down and up her children's alimentary canals for so many years that the sigh was in no sense a real signal of defeat, and she said almost immediately, "I don't see how you expect to get your strength and all back if you don't take something nourishing into your system. I'm sorry, but I don't. You've had exactly..." "Mother, now, please, I've asked you 20 times, will you please stop mentioning chicken broth to me? It nauseates me just to..." Franny broke off and listened. "Is that our phone?" she said. Mrs. Glass was already up from her chair. Her lips had tightened a bit. The ring of a telephone, anywhere, invariably caused Mrs. Glass's lips to tighten a bit. "I'll be right back," she said, and left the room. She was chinking more audibly than usual, as if a box of assorted household nails had come apart in one of her kimono pockets. She was gone about 5 minutes. When she returned, she had the particular facial expression that her eldest daughter, Boo Boo, had once described as meaning one of only two things: that she had just talked with one of her sons on the telephone, or that she had just had a report on the best authority that the bowels of every single human being in the world were scheduled to move with perfect hygienic regularity for a period of 1 full week. "That's Buddy on the phone," she announced as she came into the room. From a habit of several years' standing, she suppressed any small token of pleasure that might have slipped into her voice. Franny's visible reaction to this news was considerably less than enthusiastic. She looked, in fact, nervous. "Where's he phoning from?" she said. "I didn't even ask him. He sounds as though he has a horrible cold." Mrs. Glass didn't sit down. She hovered. "Hurry up now, little lady. He wants to talk to you." "Did he say so?" "Certainly he said so. Hurry up now. Put your slippers on." Franny let herself out of the pink sheets and the pale blue afghan. She sat, pale and obviously stalling, on the couch edge, looking up at her mother. Her feet fished around for her slippers. "What'd you tell him?" she asked nervously. "Just kindly go to the phone, please, young lady," Mrs. Glass said evasively. "Just hurry a little, for goodness sakes." "I suppose you told him I'm at death's door or something," Franny said. There was no reply to this. She stood up from the couch, not so fragilely as a post-operative convalescent might have got, but with just a trace of timidity and caution, as if she expected, and perhaps rather hoped, to feel a trifle dizzy. She worked her feet more securely into her slippers and then came out from behind the coffee table, gravely untying and retying the belt of her dressing gown. A year or so earlier, in an unwarrantably self-deprecating paragraph of a letter to her brother Buddy, she had referred to her own figure as irreproachably Americanese. Watching her, Mrs. Glass, who happened to be a great judge of young girls' figures and young girls' walks, once again, in lieu of a smile, tightened her lips a bit. The instant, however, that Franny was out of sight, she turned her attention to the couch. Clearly, from her look, there were not many things in the world she disliked more than a couch, a good eiderdown couch that had been made up for sleeping purposes. She went around into the aisle made by the coffee table and began to give all the pillows in sight a therapeutic beating up. Franny, in transit, ignored the telephone in the hall. She evidently preferred to take the longest walk down the hall to her parents' bedroom, where the more popular phone in the apartment was located. Although there was nothing markedly peculiar about her gait as she moved through the hall, she neither dallied nor quite hurried. She was nonetheless very peculiarly transformed as she moved. She appeared vividly to grow younger with each step. Possibly long halls, plus the after effects of tears, plus the ring of a telephone, plus the smell of fresh paint, plus newspapers underfoot, possibly the sum of all these things was equal for her to a new doll carriage. In any case, by the time she reached her parents' bedroom door, her handsome tailored tie silk dressing gown, the emblem perhaps of all that is dormitorially chic and fatal, looked as if it had been changed into a small child's woolen bathrobe. Mr. and Mrs. Glass's bedroom reeked, and even smarted, of freshly painted walls. The furniture had been herded into the middle of the room and covered with canvas, old paint-flecked organic-looking canvas. The beds, too, had been drawn in from the wall, but they had been covered with cotton bedspreads Mrs. Glass herself had provided. The phone was now on the pillow of Mr. Glass's bed. Evidently, Mrs. Glass, too, had preferred it to the less private extension in the hall. The handpiece lay detached from its catch, waiting for Franny. It looked almost as dependent as a human being for some acknowledgement of its existence. To get to it, to redeem it, Franny had to shuffle across the floor through a quantity of newspapers and sidestep an empty paint bucket. When she did reach it, she didn't pick it up, but merely sat down beside it on the bed, looked at it, looked away from it, and pushed back her hair. The night table that ordinarily stood alongside the bed had been moved close enough to it so that Franny could reach it without quite standing up. She put her hand under a particularly soiled-looking piece of canvas, covering it, and passed the hand back and forth till she found what she was looking for, a porcelain cigarette box and a box of matches in a copper holder. She lit a cigarette, then gave the phone another long, exceedingly worried look. With the exception of her late brother Seymour, it should be noted all her brothers had overly vibrant, not to say sinewy, voices on the telephone. At this hour, it was very possible that Franny felt deeply hesitant about taking a chance on just the timbre, let alone the verbal content, of any of her brothers' voices on the phone. However, she puffed nervously on her cigarette and rather bravely picked up the phone. "Hello, buddy," she said. "Hello, sweetheart. How are you? Are you all right?" "I'm fine. How are you? You sound as though you have a cold." Then, when there was no immediate response, "I suppose Bessie's been briefing you about the hour?"
"Well, after a fashion, yes and no, you know. Are you all right, sweetheart?"
"I'm fine. You sound funny, though. Either you have a terrible cold, or this is a terrible connection. Where are you, anyway?"
"Where am I? I'm right in my element, Flopsy. I'm in a little haunted house down the road. Never mind, just talk to me."
Franny unplacidly crossed her legs. "I don't know exactly what you'd like to talk about," she said. "What old Bessie tell you, I mean?" There was a most characteristically buddy-like pause at the other end. It was exactly the kind of pause, just a trifle rich with seniority of years, that had often tried the patience of both Franny and the virtuoso at the other end of the phone when they were small children.
"Well, I'm not terribly sure what all she told me, sweetheart. Past a certain point, it's a little rude to go on listening to Bessie on the phone. I heard about the cheeseburger diet, you can be sure, and of course the Pilgrim books, and then I think I just sat with the phone at my ear, not really listening, you know."
"Oh," Franny said. She switched her cigarette over to her telephone hand and, with her free hand, reached again under the canvas cover on the night table and found a tiny ceramic ashtray, which she placed beside her on the bed. "You sound funny," she said. "Do you have a cold or what?"
"I feel wonderful, sweetheart. I'm sitting here talking to you, and I feel wonderful. It's a joy to hear your voice. I can't tell you."
Franny once again pushed back her hair with one hand. She didn't say anything.
"Flopsy, can you think of anything Bessie may have missed? You feel like talking at all?"
With her fingers, Franny slightly altered the position of her tiny ashtray beside her on the bed.
"Well, I'm a little talked out, and to be honest with you," she said. Zoe's been at me all morning. Zoe, how is he? How is he? He's fine. He's just tip-top. I could just murder him, that's all. Murder him? Why? Why, sweetheart? Why could you murder our Zoe? Why? Because I just could, that's all. He's completely destructive. I've never met anyone so completely destructive in my life. It's just so unnecessary. One minute he launches this all-out attack on the Jesus prayer, which I happen to be interested in, making you think you're some kind of neurotic nitwit for even being interested in it. And about 2 minutes later, he starts raving to you about how Jesus is the only person in the world he's ever had any respect for. Such a marvelous mind and all that. And he's just so erratic. I mean, he goes around and around in such horrible circles.
Tell about it. Tell about the horrible circles.
Here, Franny made the mistake of getting a little exhalation of impatience. She had just inhaled cigarette smoke. She coughed.
Tell about it? It would just take me all day, that's all.
She put a hand to her throat and waited for the wrong passage discomfort to pass.
He's just a monster, she said. He is not really a monster, but I don't know. He's so bitter about things. He's bitter about religion. He's bitter about television. He's bitter about you and Seymour. He keeps saying you both made freaks out of us. And I don't know. He jumps from one.
Why freaks? I know he thinks that. Or thinks he thinks it. But did he say why?
What's his definition of a freak?
He say, sweetheart? Just here, Franny, in apparent despair at the naivete of the question, struck her forehead with her hand, something she very probably hadn't done in 5 or 6 years. When, for example, halfway home on the Lexington Avenue bus, she discovered she had left her scarf back at the movies.
What's his definition? She said. He has about 40 definitions for everything. If I sound slightly unhinged, that's the reason why. One minute, like last night, he says we're freaks because we were brought up to have only one set of standards. 10 minutes later, he's a freak because he never wants to meet anybody for a drink. The only time...
Never wants to what?
Meet anybody for a drink. Oh, he had to go out last night and meet this television writer for a drink downtown in the Village and all. That's what started it. He says the only people he ever really wants to meet for a drink somewhere are all either dead or unavailable. He says he never even wants to have lunch with anybody. Even unless he thinks there's a good chance it's going to turn out to be Jesus the person, or the Buddha, or Wing Ning, or Shankaracharya, or somebody like that, you know?
Franny suddenly put out her cigarette in the tiny ashtray with some awkwardness, not having her second hand free to brace the ashtray.
You know what else he said to me? She said, you know what he swore up and down to me? He told me last night he once had a glass of ginger ale with Jesus in the kitchen when he was 8 years old. Are you listening?
I'm listening. I'm listening, sweetheart.
He said he was, this is exactly what he said. He said he was sitting at the table in the kitchen all by himself, drinking a glass of ginger ale and eating saltines and reading Dombey and Son, and all of a sudden Jesus sat down in the other chair and asked if he could have a small glass of ginger ale. A small glass, mind you. That's exactly what he said. I mean, he says things like that, and yet he thinks he's perfectly qualified to give me a lot of advice and stuff. That's what makes me so mad. I could just spit. I could. It's like being in a lunatic asylum and having another patient all dressed up as a doctor come over to you and start taking your pulse or something. It's just awful. He talks and talks and talks and talks. And if he isn't talking, he's smoking his smelly cigars all over the house. I'm so sick of the smell of cigar smoke, I could just roll over and die.
The cigars are ballast, sweetheart, sheer ballast. If he didn't have a cigar to hold on to, his feet would leave the ground. We'd never see our Zoe again. There were several experienced verbal stunt pilots in the Glass family, but this last little remark, perhaps Zoe alone was coordinated well enough to bring in safely over a telephone. Or so this narrator suggests, and Franny may have felt so too. In any case, she suddenly knew that it was Zoe at the other end of the phone. She got up slowly from the edge of the bed.
All right, Zoe, she said, all right.
Not quite immediately, Beg pardon?
I said, all right, Zoe.
Zoe, what is this, Franny? You there?
I'm here. Just stop it now, please. I know it's you.
What in the world are you talking about, sweetheart? What is this? Who's this Zoe?
Zoe Glass, Franny said. Just stop it now, please. You're not being funny. As it happens, I'm just barely getting back to feeling halfway.
Grass, did you say? Zoe Grass? Norwegian chap? Sort of a heavy-set blonde
All right, Zoe, just stop, please. Enough's enough. You're not funny. In case you're interested, I'm feeling absolutely lousy now. So if there's anything special you have to say to me, please hurry up and say it and leave me alone.
This last emphasized word was oddly veered away from, as if the stress on it hadn't been fully intended. There was a peculiar silence at the other end of the phone, and a peculiar reaction to it from Franny. She was disturbed by it. She sat down again on the edge of her father's bed.
I'm not going to hang up on you or anything, she said, but I don't know, I'm tired, Zoe. I'm just exhausted, frankly.
She listened, but there was no response. She crossed her legs.
You can go on like this all day, but I can't, she said. All I am is on the receiving end. It isn't terribly pleasant, you know. You think everybody's made of iron or something?
She listened. She started to speak up again, but stopped when she heard the sound of a voice being cleared. I don't think everybody's made of iron, buddy. This abjectly simple sentence seemed to disturb Franny rather more than a continued silence would have. She quickly reached over and picked a cigarette out of the porcelain box, but didn't prepare to light it.
Well, you'd think you did, she said.
She listened. She waited.
I mean, did you call for any special reason? She said abruptly. I mean, did you have any special reason for calling me?
No special reason, buddy. No special reason.
Franny waited. Then the other end spoke up again. I suppose I'm more or less called to tell you to go on with your Jesus prayer if you want to. I mean, that's your business. That's your business. It's a goddamn nice prayer, and don't let anybody tell you anything different.
I know, Franny said. Very nervously, she reached out for the box of matches.
I don't think I ever really meant to try to stop you from saying it. At least I don't think I did. I don't know. I don't know what the hell was going on in my mind. There's one thing I do know for sure, though. I have no goddamn authority to be speaking up like a seer the way I've been. We've had enough goddamn seers in this family. That part bothers me. That part scares me a little bit.
Franny took advantage of the slight pause that followed to straighten her back a trifle, as though, for some reason, good posture or better posture might come in handy at any moment.
It scares me a little bit, but it doesn't petrify me. Let's get that straight. It doesn't petrify me, because you forget one thing, buddy. When you first felt the urge, the call to say the prayer, you didn't immediately start searching the four corners of the world for a master. You came home. You not only came home, but you went into a goddamn collapse. So if you look at it in a certain way, by rights, you're only entitled to the low-grade spiritual counsel we're able to give you around here, and no more. At least you know there won't be any goddamn ulterior motives in this madhouse. Whatever we are, we're not fishy, buddy.
Franny suddenly tried with one hand alone to get a light for her cigarette. She opened the matchbox compartment successfully, but one inept scratch of a match sent the box to the floor. She bent quickly and picked up the box and let the spilled matches lie.
I'll tell you one thing, Franny. One thing I know, and don't get upset. It isn't really anything bad. But if it's the religious life you want, you ought to know right now that you're missing out on every single goddamn religious action that's going on around this house. You don't even have enough sense to drink when somebody brings you a cup of consecrated chicken soup, which is the only kind of chicken soup Bessie ever brings to anybody around this madhouse. So just tell me, buddy, even if you went out and searched the whole world for a master,
some guru, some holy man to tell you how to say your Jesus prayer properly? What good would it do you? How in hell are you going to recognize a legitimate holy man when you see one if you don't even know a cup of consecrated chicken soup when it's right in front of your nose? Can you tell me that? Franny was now sitting up rather abnormally straight. I'm just asking you. I'm not trying to upset you. Am I upsetting you? Franny answered, but her answer evidently didn't carry. What? I can't hear you.
I said no. Where are you calling from? Where are you now?
Oh, what the hell's the difference where I am? Pierre, South Dakota, for God's sake. Listen to me, Franny. I'm sorry. Don't get riled, but listen to me. I have just one or two very small things more, and then I'll quit. I promise you that.
But did you know, just by the way, that Buddy and I drove up to see you in stock last summer? Did you know we saw you in Playboy of the Western World one night?
One god-awful hot night. I can tell you that. But did you know we were there? An answer seemed to be called for. Franny stood up, then immediately sat down. She placed the ashtray slightly away from her, as if it were very much in her way.
No, I didn't, she said. Nobody said one single... No, I didn't.
Well, we were. We were. And I'll tell you, Buddy, you were good. And when I say good, I mean good. You held that goddamn mess up. Even all those sunburned lobsters in the audience knew it. And now I hear you're finished with the theater forever. I hear things. And I remember the spiel you came back with when the season was over. Oh, you irritate me, Franny. I'm sorry you do. You've made the great startling goddamn discovery that the acting profession's loaded with mercenaries and butchers. As I remember, you even looked like somebody who'd just been shattered because all the ushers hadn't been geniuses. What's the matter with you, Buddy? Where are your brains? If you've had a freakish education, at least use it. Use it. You can say the Jesus prayer from now till doomsday, but if you don't realize that the only thing that counts in the religious life is detachment, I don't see how you'll ever even move an inch. Detachment, Buddy, and only detachment. Desirelessness. Cessation from all hankerings. It's this business of desiring, if you want to know the goddamn truth, that makes an actor in the first place. Why are you making me tell you things you already know? Somewhere along the line, in one damn incarnation or another, if you like, you not only had a hankering to be an actor or an actress, but to be a good one. You're stuck with it now. You can't just walk out on the results of all your own hankerings. Cause and effect, Buddy. Cause and effect. The only thing you can do now, the only religious thing you can do now, is act. Act for God if you want to. Be God's actress if you want to. What could be prettier? You can at least try to if you want to. There's nothing wrong in trying. There was a slight pause. You better get busy, though, Buddy. The goddamn sands run out on you every time you turn around. I know what I'm talking about. You're lucky if you get time to sneeze in this goddamn phenomenal world. There was another slighter pause. I used to worry about that. I don't worry about it that much anymore. At least, I'm still in love with Yorick's skull. At least, I always have time enough to stay in love with Yorick's skull. I want an honorable goddamn skull when I'm dead, Buddy. I hanker after an honorable goddamn skull like Yorick's. And so do you, Franny Glass. So do you. So do you. Ah, God, what's the use of talking? You had the exact same goddamn freakish upbringing I did, and if you don't know by this time what kind of skull you want when you're dead and what you have to do to earn it, I mean, if you don't at least know by this time that if you're an actress you're supposed to act, then what's the use of talking? Franny was now sitting with the flat of her hand pressed against the side of her face, like someone with an excruciating toothache. one other thing, and that's all, I promise you. But the thing is, you raved and you bitched when you came home about the stupidity of audiences. The goddamned unskilled laughter coming from the fifth row. And that's right, God knows it's depressing. I'm not saying it isn't. But that's none of your business, really. That's none of your business, Franny. An artist's only concern is to shoot for some kind of perfection, and on his own terms, not anyone else's. You have no right to think about those things, I swear to you. Not in any real sense, anyway. You know what I mean? There was silence. Both saw it through without any seeming impatience or awkwardness. Franny still appeared to have some considerable pain on one side of her face and continued to keep her hand on it. But her expression was markedly uncomplaining. The voice at the other end came through again. I remember about the fifth time I ever went on Wise Child. I subbed for Walt a few times when he was in the cast. Remember when he was in the cast? Anyway, I started bitching one night before the broadcast. Seymour told me to shine my shoes just as I was going out the door with Waker. I was furious. The studio audience were all morons. The announcer was a moron. The sponsors were morons. And I just damn well wasn't going to shine my shoes for them, I told Seymour. I said they couldn't see them anyway. Not where we sat. He said to shine them anyway. He said to shine them for the fat lady. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but he had a very Seymour look on his face. And so I did it. He never did tell me who the fat lady was, but I shined my shoes for the fat lady every time I ever went on the air again. All the years you and I were on the program together, if you remember. I don't think I missed more than just a couple of times. This terribly clear picture of the fat lady formed in my mind. I had her sitting on this porch all day, swatting flies with her radio going full blast from morning till night. I figured the heat was terrible, and she probably had cancer, and I don't know. Anyway, it seemed goddamn clear why Seymour wanted me to shine my shoes when I went on the air. It made sense. Franny was standing. She had taken her hand away from her face to hold the phone with two hands. "He told me to," she said into the phone. "He told me to be funny for the fat lady once." She released one hand from the phone and placed it very briefly on the crown of her head, and then went back to holding the phone with both hands. I didn't ever picture her on a porch, but with very, very thick legs, very veiny. I had her in an awful wicker chair. She had cancer, too, though, and she had the radio going full blast all day. Mine did, too. "Yes, yes, yes, all right. Let me tell you something now, buddy. Are you listening?" Franny, looking extremely tense, nodded. "I don't care where an actor acts. It can be in summer stock. It can be over a radio. It can be over television. It can be in a goddamn Broadway theater, complete with the most fashionable, most well-fed, most sunburned-looking audience you can imagine. But I'll tell you a terrible secret. Are you listening to me? There isn't anyone out there who isn't Seymour's fat lady. That includes your Professor Tupper, buddy, and all his goddamn cousins by the dozens. There isn't anyone anywhere that isn't Seymour's fat lady. Don't you know that? Don't you know that goddamn secret yet? And don't you know, listen to me now, don't you know who that fat lady really is? Ah, buddy, it's Christ himself. Christ himself, buddy." For joy, apparently, it was all Franny could do to hold the phone, even with both hands. For a foolish half minute or so, there were no other words, no further speech. Then, "I can't talk anymore, buddy." The sound of a phone being replaced in its catch followed. Franny took in her breath slightly, but continued to hold the phone to her ear. a dial tone, of course, followed the formal break in the connection. She appeared to find it extraordinarily beautiful to listen to, rather as if it were the best possible substitute for the primordial silence itself. But she seemed to know, too, when to stop listening to it, as if all of what little or much wisdom there is in the world were suddenly hers. When she had replaced the phone, she seemed to know just what to do next. She cleared away the smoking things, drew back the cotton bedspread from the bed she had been sitting on, took off her slippers, and got into the bed. For some minutes before she fell into a deep, dreamless sleep, she just lay quiet, smiling at the ceiling. And now, from the personal history section of the July 28, 2008 issue of the New Yorker magazine, all the answers, the quiz show scandals of the 1950s and the aftermath, by Charles Van Doren. For 14 weeks in the winter and spring of 1956 and 57, I came into millions of American homes, stood in a supposedly soundproof booth, and answered difficult questions. I was considered well-spoken, well-educated, handsome, the very image of a young man that parents would like their son to be. I was also thought to be the ideal teacher, which is to say patient, thoughtful, trustworthy, caring. In addition, I was making a small fortune. And then, well, this is what happened. I don't remember the dinner clearly, except that at some point in the early fall of 1956, I was talking with a man named Albert Friedman, who knew a friend of mine. Friedman was about my age, suave and well-dressed, certainly no bohemian, like most of my friends. He asked me what I thought of Tic-Tac-Doe. I didn't have a television set in those days, but I knew that Al Friedman was in the TV business. And I'd certainly heard about the game shows where people could win a lot of money. Al told me that the contestants on the $64,000 question could win that amount, and on some shows they could win even more. "Your father's a professor at Columbia," he asked, and when I nodded, he asked if I was too. I told him that I was an instructor of English, a long way from being a professor. I was not comfortable talking about myself, especially when he asked me how much an instructor of English made. When I told him, he just looked at me. Friedman called me a few days later. When I learned what he wanted, I telephoned Jerry, Geraldine Bernstein, the young woman I had been dating and whom I married 6 months later. I told her that Al had persuaded me to take a test and that, depending on how I did, they might want me for a new show called 21, which was structured like blackjack. "The winner gets quite a bit," I said. "The guy who's on the show now has already won something like $25,000. "Promise me you won't agree to do this without talking to me first," I remember her saying. "Okay, I promise. They probably won't ask me." They did. At least Al Friedman did. He called me and told me that his job was on the line. A man named Herb Stemple was winning week after week, but he wasn't popular and the ratings were suffering. "They want me to find a contestant who can beat Herb Stemple," Al said. "It might be you." It wasn't hard to guess why Al was interested in me. My father was Mark Van Doren, a poet and critic, and, as Al Friedman knew, a legendary teacher. My Uncle Carl, his oldest brother, had been a professor of American literature at Columbia University. The first time Al called, he asked me to come to his apartment. When I arrived, he seemed nervous. I wondered what I was getting into. "Right away," he said, "you remember I told you about this fellow Stemple? Well, the sponsors want him to be beaten. He'll walk away with a bundle, but they want somebody more sympathetic." "Do they have a right to do that?" "Hey, come off it, Charlie. Don't be naive." And then he came right out and said it. "I've thought about it, Charlie, and I've decided you should be the person to beat Stemple, and I'll help you do it." He held up his hand. "I swear to you, no one will ever know. It will be just between you and me. Jack Barry, the show's host, won't even know, and Dan Enright won't either. Stemple won't know. I've got a way to handle that. The sponsors won't know. Anyway, they'll be so happy they won't give a damn. And the audience will never know because I won't tell them and you won't either." "How would you do it?" "Oh, Jack would ask you a question you could answer and Stemple couldn't." My first appearance on 21 was on November 28, 1956. Herb Stemple, by then, had been on the show for six straight weeks and had won some $70,000.
You can quit right now, Jack Barry was saying to Simple in a voice practiced in arousing suspense, and a check will be waiting for you, or you can decide to continue playing. Barry introduced me and then asked me if I was related in any way to Mark Van Doren up at Columbia, the famous writer. Papa, forgive me. Mama, forgive me. Uncle Carl, forgive me. I've remembered that moment for more than 50 years. Al had given me my instructions. My understanding was that I was to reach 17 points in the first round, 21 in the second, at which point I'd defeat Herb Stemple. To my astonishment, both Stemple and I reached 21 points in the second round, so bells rang, commercials were read, and both of us agreed to come back a week later. It was then, on December 5th, 1956, that I beat Herb Stemple and began my rise to celebrity. I learned later that the question Stemple missed was one that he could have answered easily, but they had him. If he failed to go along with his script, he could lose a lot of the money he had already won. I continued to appear on 21 until March 11, 1957. During those 4 months, Friedman never stopped coaching me, and I came to see just how carefully controlled the show was. For several weeks, the programs had ended in ties between me and a lawyer named Vivian Nearing. At one point, it looked as if I could have won more than $150,000, except I couldn't, because Al had informed me that I would lose to her. On the evening of March 11th, Jack Barry asked both of us to name the kings of Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Jordan, Iraq, and Belgium. According to our covert script, Nearing knew the answers, and I didn't. I was paid $128,000, and I was going to go to work for the National Broadcasting Company, which was willing to sign me to a 3-year contract as a consultant on public service and educational broadcasting at an annual rate of $50,000. NBC News tried hard to find work for me as a writer of radio news breaks, for example, but I wasn't very good at it. In the summer of 1958, they assigned me to the White House. This was a strange experience. NBC's old Washington hands weren't welcoming me. I did better doing segments of Dave Garraway's Wide, Wide World show, a Sunday afternoon cultural program. I soon became a semi-regular on this program, appearing once a month in place of Garraway. In the summer of 1958, stories appeared in the New York Post and later in the Hearst newspapers, the Daily Mirror and the Journal American, raising questions about the quiz shows. People who knew the entertainment business didn't have much doubt about what was going on, although they didn't speak out. Why would they? At the height of the boom, there were as many as 24 primetime shows, each giving away significant sums, attracting large audiences, and producing large profits for the sponsors. In October of 1958, Joseph Stone, a Manhattan assistant district attorney, called and wanted to ask me a few questions. They wanted me to come downtown. I can't remember the venue, but I remember that it made me very uneasy. Stone's grilling went on for an hour or so after that. I never admitted that I had received help. Finally, Stone said that I was free to go. I'll never forget his last words. You can lie to me, but I'm not going to let you lie to the grand jury. The grand jury was being convened, and I would have to testify. When I went before the grand jury, I wasn't sure what I would say. When I looked at the jurors' faces, I saw that the foreman was a senior professor at Columbia, a man I knew by sight, and I panicked, thinking that if I told him the truth, I would be, in effect, telling everyone at the university. So I lied. The congressional hearings began on Tuesday, October 6, 1959, and my turn came on Monday, November 2nd. I asked permission to read my statement. In it, I told the entire story for the first time. The committee members asked a few questions, but there was really not much else to say, and they told me that I was free to go. When I stepped out the door of the caucus room, I saw a large crowd, members of the press, photographers, and bystanders. I realized that there was no way to avoid repeating my testimony. I was, I said, foolish, naive, prideful, and avaricious, and added, I have deceived my friends, and I had millions of them. Along with Vivian Nearing and 8 others, I later pleaded guilty to second-degree perjury, a misdemeanor, for lying to the grand jury about getting answers from producers. The 6 weeks between my confession and Christmas of that year, 1959, were mostly agony. But a small gift from my father helped me through it. He had wrapped a square box in tissue paper sealed with scotch tape. The box contained a gyroscope compass. A card in the box read,
May this be for you the whirligig of time that brings in his revenges. I knew the quotation. It's from Twelfth Night. Fest, the mean-spirited clown, has been unmasked, but those are his last words, thrown over his shoulder. The play's audience knows that somehow he will survive and live to taunt some other master. I knew he was saying that I, too, would survive and somehow find a way back. I just hugged him and said, "Thank you, Papa." In 1992, The Quiz Show Scandal, written and co-produced by Julian Cranon for American Experience, appeared on WGBH. The program was pretty good. I learned some things I hadn't known, one of which was that about 100 contestants had lied to the grand jury, although only 17 of us were indicted, arrested, and arraigned. None of us was sentenced to jail. It brought back to me how we were marched through the streets of downtown New York, accompanied by photographers, forced to hand over our valuables, take off our belts and shoelaces, and get fingerprinted. I hadn't remembered that this had happened to anyone but me. I suppose I'd been in shock. I do remember that it was hard to keep my trousers up because I'd lost weight. I also learned that when 21 was first on, it wasn't rigged, and it was, therefore, a failure. Herb Stemple was the first to agree to the fix. It was said that 50 million people watched us on the night when he took a dive, as he put it. I learned that Al Friedman eventually got an executive job at Penthouse International, and that after 10 years or so, Barry and Enright were allowed to come back to television and resume their partnership with new programs. Robert Redford's film, The Quiz Show, opened in 1994, and I eventually saw it. I understand that movies need to compress and conflate, but what bothered me most was the epilogue stating that I never taught again. I didn't stop teaching, although it was a long time before I taught again in college. I did enjoy John Turturro's version of Stemple, and I couldn't help but laugh when Stemple referred to me in the film as Charles Van Effing Moron. Spring of 2008, my wife and I went to Rome for a 50th anniversary gift to one another, and one morning I took my little gyroscope out of my toilet kit, where it has traveled with me since 1959. I set it spinning on the edge of my orange juice glass, and, as I looked at it, I said thank you to it and to my father and my mother and to all the other people who helped us to survive. The previous article was edited for length. And we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.